possible to construct a misanthropist's manifesto. The rules of human conduct by which we should live. Imagine how Arthur, adhering to this manifesto, might have fared in a contemporary therapy group. Do not tell a friend what your enemy ought not to know. Regard all personal affairs as secrets, and remain complete strangers, even to our close friends. With changed circumstances, their knowledge of the most harmless things about us may be to our disadvantage. Giving way neither to love nor to hate is one half of world wisdom. To say nothing and believe nothing, the other half. Distrust is the mother of safety, a French proverb, cited approvingly. To forget at any time the bad traits of a man's character is like throwing away hard-earned money. We must protect ourselves from foolish familiarity and foolish friendship. The only way to attain superiority in dealing with men is to let it be seen you are independent of them. To disregard is to win regard. If we really think highly of a person, we should conceal it from him like a crime. Better to let men be what they are than to take them for what they are not. We must never show anger and hatred except in our actions. It is only the cold-blooded animals that are poisonous. By being polite and friendly, you can make people pliable and obliging. Hence politeness is to human nature what warmth is to wax. 26. There are few ways by which you can make more certain of putting people into a good humor than by telling them of some trouble that has recently befallen you, or by disclosing some personal weakness of yours. At the next meeting, Gil plunked himself down, his huge frame testing the limits of his chair, waited until everyone arrived, and started the meeting. If no one else has something, I want to continue with the secrets exercise. Let me insert a cautionary note here, said Julius. I don't think it's a good idea to make this a prescribed exercise. I do believe that folks do better in the group when they reveal themselves fully, but it's important to move at our own pace and not feel pressured by any exercise to open up. I hear you, answered Gil. But I don't feel pressured. I want to talk about this. And I also don't want to leave Rebecca and Stuart hanging out there alone. That okay? After noting the nods in the group, Gil continued. My secret goes back to when I was 13. I was a virgin, barely into puberty, covered with acne. And Aunt Valerie, my father's youngest sister, she was late 20s or early 30s, used to stay with us from time to time. She was between jobs a lot. We got along great, played around a lot when my folks were out, wrestling, tickling, card games. Then, one time, when I cheated at strip poker and got her naked, things got real sexual. No longer tickling, but some serious feeling up. I was inexperienced and hormone hot and didn't know exactly what was going on. But when she said to stick it in, I said, yes, ma'am, and followed instructions. After that, we did it any time we could until a couple months later when my folks came home early and caught us red-handed. Flat out in the act. What's that called? Flagrant? Flagrant something? Gil looked toward Philip, who opened his mouth to answer but was preempted by Pam, who said with lightning speed, Flagrante delicto. Wow. Fast, I forgot we have two professors here, murmured Gil, who continued his account. Well, the whole thing kind of messed up the family. My dad didn't get too hot under the collar about it, but my mother was livid, and Aunt Val didn't stay with us anymore, and my mother was furious with Dad for continuing to be friendly with her. Gil stopped, looked around, and then added, I can understand why my mother was upset, but still, it was as much my fault as Aunt Val's.
Your fault? At 13? Come on, said Bonnie.
Others, Stuart, Tony, Rebecca, nodded in agreement. Before Gil could respond, Pam said,
I've got a response, Gil.
Maybe not what you're expecting, but something I've been holding back. Something I wanted to say to you even before I left on my trip. I don't know how to put it tactfully, Gil. So I'm just gonna try. Just gonna cut loose. Bottom line is that your story doesn't move me one bit. And in most ways, you just don't move me. Even though you say you're revealing yourself like Rebecca and Stuart did, I don't experience you as being personal. I know you're committed to the group, Pam continued. You seem to work hard. You take a lot of responsibility for taking care of others. And if someone runs out, it's usually you that runs to get them back. You seem to reveal yourself, but you don't. It's an illusion. You stay hidden.
Yes, that's what you are. Hidden, hidden, hidden. Your story about your aunt is so typical of what I mean. It seems personal, but it's not. It's a trick because it's not your story. It's your Aunt Val's story. And of course, everyone is going to jump in and say, but you were only a child, you were 13, you were the victim. What else could they say? And your stories about your marriage have always been about Rose, never about you. And they always get exactly the same response from us. Why do you put up with that shit? When I was meditating in India, bored out of my gourd, I thought a lot about this group. You can't believe how much. And I thought about each person here, except for you, Gil. I hate to say this, but I just didn't think about you. When you talk, I never know who you're talking to, maybe the walls or the floor. But I never experience you as speaking personally to me.
Silence. The members seemed bewildered about how to respond. Then Tony whistled and said, Welcome back, Pam.
No sense of being here if I'm not going to be honest, said Pam.
What are you feeling, Gil? Asked Julius. Oh, just my typical feeling when I get a drop kick to my belly, spitting out a few pieces of pancreas. Is that personal enough, Pam?
Wait, sorry. Don't answer.
I didn't mean that. I know you're giving me good straight stuff. And deep down, I know you're right.
Say more about that, Gil. About her being right, said Julius.
She's right. I could reveal more. I know that. I have things I could say to people here.
To who, for example? Asked Bonnie.
Well, you. I really like you, Bonnie.
Nice to hear, Gil, but it's still not too personal.
Well, I got off on you calling me a hunk a couple weeks ago. And I don't buy into your labeling yourself homely and so out of Rebecca's beauty league. I've always had a thing, maybe ever since Aunt Val, about older women. And I'll be honest, I had some juicy fantasies when you invited me to stay at your place when I didn't want to go home to Rose. That why you didn't take Bonnie up on her offer? Asked Tony. Other stuff came up. When it was clear Gil was not going to elaborate, Tony asked, You want to say more about this other stuff?
Gil sat for a moment, his bald pate glistening with sweat, and then mustered resolved and said,
Tell you what, let me go around the rest of the group and talk about my feelings. He began with Stuart, who sat next to Bonnie. For you, Stuart, I got nothing but admiration. If I had kids, I'd feel lucky to have you as their doctor. And what you described last week doesn't change any of my feelings. And you, Rebecca,
Tell you the truth, you intimidate me. And you seem too perfect, too pretty, too clean. What you told us about the incident in Las Vegas doesn't change that. To me, you're still pristine and spotless with tons of confidence. Maybe it's because I'm flustered now. But I can't even remember why you're in therapy. Stuart's image of you being a porcelain doll, that rings true. Maybe you're a little too brittle, maybe you've got some sharp edges, I don't know. And Pam, you're a straight shooter, blunt. Smartest person I'd ever met until Philip entered. He can give you a run for it. I know I don't want to get on the wrong side of either of you, but Pam, you've got stuff to work on with men. They've given you hard times, but then again, you hate us. All of us. Hard to know what's chicken, what's egg. Philip, you're way up there, like in another whole layer or realm of being. But I wonder about you. I wonder if you've ever had a friend. I can't see you actually hanging out, having a beer, talking about the Giants. I can't see you having a good time or actually ever liking anyone. And I'll tell you the real question for me. Why aren't you lonely? Gil continued on. Tony, you're fascinating to me. You work with your hands, you really do things, not push numbers around like me. I wish you weren't so ashamed of your work. Well, that's everybody.
No, it's not, said Rebecca, glancing toward Julius.
Oh, Julius? He's of the group, not in the group.
What's of the group mean?
Asked Rebecca. Oh, I don't know, just a cute phrase I heard and been wanting to use. Julius, he's there for me, for everyone. He's far above us, the way he...
He? Asked Julius, pantomiming searching about the group. Where is this he guy? Okay, I mean you, Julius. The way you're handling your illness. I mean, it's impressive. I'll never forget it.
Gil stopped. Everyone's attention remained riveted upon him, but he exhaled with a loud whoosh. He looked as though he had had it and settled back in his chair, obviously fatigued, and took out a handkerchief and wiped his face and head. Sentiments such as, "Good job, you took some risks," were voiced by Rebecca, Stuart, Tony, and Bonnie. Pam and Philip remained silent. "How was that, Gil? You satisfied?" asked Julius. Gil nodded. "I broke some new ground. Hope I didn't offend." "How about you, Pam? You satisfied?"
"I've already put in my time today as the group bitch."
"Gil, let me ask you to do something," said Julius. "Imagine a continuum of self-revealing. At one pole, which we'll call one, is the safest revealing, cocktail party stuff. And at the other pole, call it 10, would be the deepest and riskiest revealing you can possibly imagine. Got that?"
Gil nodded. "Now look back on your go-around just now. Tell me, Gil, what kind of score would you give yourself?" Continuing to nod, Gil answered swiftly, "I'd give myself a 4, maybe a 5. Julius, wanting to circumvent intellectualization or other defenses from Gil's arsenal of resistance, responded instantly. "And now tell me, Gil, what would happen if you were to ratchet it up a notch or two?"
"If I were to ratchet up a notch or two," Gil replied without hesitation, "I'd tell the group I was an alcoholic and that I'd drink myself to unconsciousness every night." The group was stunned, Julius no less than the others. Before he had brought Gil into the group, he had seen him in individual therapy for 2 years, and never, not once, had Gil mentioned an alcohol problem. How could this be? Julius was congenitally trusting of his patients. He was one of those optimistic souls who was greatly destabilized by duplicity. He felt wobbly and needed time to formulate a new vision of Gil. As he mused silently about his own naivete and the tenuousness of reality, the mood of the group darkened and progressed from incredulousness to stridency.
What? You're joking!
I can't believe it. How could you have come here week after week and withhold this?
And you never took a drink with me, not even a beer. What was that all about?
God damn it. When I think of all the wild goose chases you led us on, all the time we wasted.
What kind of game were you playing?
Everything a lie. I mean, that stuff about Rose's problems, her bitchiness, her refusing sex, her refusal to have a child, and not a word about the real issue. You're drinking.
Once Julius got his bearings, he understood what to do. A basic axiom that he taught to his group therapy students was, members should never be punished for self-disclosure. On the contrary, risk-taking must always be supported and reinforced. With that in mind, he said to the group, I understand your dismay that Gil never told us this before. But let's not forget one important thing. Today, Gil did open up. He did trust us. As he spoke, he glanced for only a moment at Philip, hoping that Philip would learn something about therapy from this transaction. Then to Gil. What I'm wondering about is what made it possible for you to take this kind of chance today. Gil, too ashamed to face the others, concentrated his attention on Julius and replied in a chastened tone. I guess it was the risky revealing in the last couple of meetings, beginning with Pam and Philip and then Rebecca and Stuart. I'm pretty sure that's why I could say,
How long? Interrupted Rebecca. How long have you been an alcoholic?
Creeps up on you, you know, so I'm not sure. I always liked the booze, but I guess I started meeting all the criteria about 5 years ago.
You're what kind of an alcoholic? Asked Tony.
My favorite poison is scotch, cabernet, and black Russians. But I don't turn down anything. Vodka, gin. Totally ambidextrous.
What I meant was, when and how much, said Tony.
Gil showed no defensiveness and seemed prepared to answer any question.
Mostly after hours. I start with scotches as soon as I get home, or before I get home if Rose has given me a hard time. And then I work my way through good wine the rest of the evening, at least a bottle, sometimes two, until I pass out in front of the TV.
Where's Rose on this? Asked Pam.
Well, we used to be big wine buffs together. Built a 2,000-bottle cellar, went to auctions. But she's not encouraging my drinking now. Now she rarely has a glass at dinner and wants no part of any wine-related activities, except for some of her big social wine-tasting events.
Julius tried to buck the current and bring the group back to the here and now.
I'm trying to imagine how you must have felt coming to meeting after meeting here and not talking about this.
It wasn't easy, Gil admitted, shaking his head.
Julius always taught students the difference between vertical and horizontal self-disclosure. The group was pressing, as expected, for vertical disclosure. Details about the past, including such queries as the scope and duration of his drinking. Whereas horizontal disclosure, that is, disclosure about the disclosure, was always far more productive. This meeting was vintage stuff for teaching, Julius mused, and reminded himself to remember the sequence of events for future lectures and writing. And then, with a thud, he recalled that the future had no relevance for him. Though the poisonous black wart had been carved out of his shoulder, he knew that somewhere in his body, lethal colonies of melanoma remained,
voracious cells that craved life more than his own fatigue cells. They were there, pulsating, gulping oxygen and nutrients, growing and gathering strength. And his dark thoughts were always there also, percolating under the membrane of consciousness. Thank God for his one method of stilling his terror. Entering into life as forcefully as possible. The extraordinarily intense life being lived in this group was very good medicine for him. He pressed Gil. Say more about what passed through your mind during all those months of group meetings.
What do you mean? Said Gil.
Well, you said it wasn't easy. Say more about that. About those meetings and why it wasn't easy.
I'd come here all primed but could never unload. Something always stopped me.
Dig into that. The something that stopped you. Julius was rarely so directive in the group, but he was convinced that he knew how to move the discussion in a beneficial direction that the group might not take on its own.
I like this group, Gil said. These are the most important people in my life. I've never been a real member of anything before. I was afraid I'd lose my place, lose any credibility. Exactly like what's happening now, right now. People hate drunks. The group will want to boot me out. You'll tell me to go to AA. The group will judge me, not help me.
That was exactly the cue Julius had been waiting for. He moved quickly.
Gil, look around the room. Tell me, who are the judges here?
Everyone's a judge.
All identically? I doubt it.
Try to discriminate. Look around the group. Who are the main judges?
Gil kept his gaze on Julius.
Well, Tony can come down on you pretty hard, but no, not on this. He likes his booze, too. That what you want?
Julius nodded encouragement.
Bonnie? Gil continued to speak directly to Julius. No, she's no judge. Except of herself and, once in a while, of Rebecca. She's always gentle with me.
Stuart, well, he's one of the judges. He definitely has a self-righteous streak. Pretty goody-goody sometimes. And Rebecca, for sure. I hear a lot of directives. Be like me, be sure, be thorough, be dressed right, be washed, be neat. That's why I felt released when Rebecca and Stuart showed so much vulnerability. That made it possible for me to open up. And Pam. She's the judge. Chief Justice. No doubt about it. I know she thinks I'm weak, unfair to Rose, you name it. Everything about me is wrong. I don't have much hope of pleasing her. In fact, I don't have any hope. He halted.
Guess that's it, he said, scanning the group.
Oh, yes. Philip.
He spoke to Philip directly, unlike the other members.
Let's see. I don't think of you judging me, but I'm not sure that's entirely a compliment. It's more that you wouldn't get close enough or involved enough with me even to bother judging me.
Julius was well pleased. He had diffused the non-constructive moan of betrayal and the punitive grilling of Gil. It was a matter of timing. Sooner or later, the details of his alcoholism would be aired, but not at this moment and in this manner. What's more, Julius's focus on horizontal disclosure had yielded a bonus. Gil's 10-minute gutsy go-round was a bonanza of data, enough there to fuel a couple of good sessions. Turning to the group, Julius said, "Reactions, anyone?" There was hesitation. Not, he imagined, because there was so little to say, but too much. The agenda groaned with its own weight. The members had to have reactions to Gil's confession, to his alcoholism, and his sudden toughness in the last few minutes. He waited expectantly. Good stuff was on its way. He noted that Philip was looking at him, and for a moment their gazes met. That was unusual. Perhaps, Julius thought. Philip was signaling his appreciation of the finesse with which he had conducted this meeting. Or perhaps Philip was pondering Gil's feedback to him. Julius decided to inquire and nodded at Philip. No response. So he said, "Philip, you are feeling so far about this meeting?"
"I've been wondering whether you were going to participate."
"Participate?" Julius was astounded. "I've been wondering if I were too active, too directive today."
"I meant participate in the sharing of secrets," said Philip.
Will the time ever come, Julius thought, when Philip will say something even vaguely predictable? "Philip, I'm not evading your question, but there are some pressing loose ends here." He turned to Gil. "I'm concerned about where you are now."
"I'm on overload. My only issue is whether you'll allow me to stay in the group as an alcoholic," said Gil, whose forehead glistened with perspiration.
"Sounds like this is the time you need us most. I wonder, though, if your bringing it up today indicates that you're gathering resolve to do something about it. Perhaps entering a recovery program?"
"Yep. After this meeting, I can't keep doing what I'm doing. I may need to call you for an individual session, okay?"
"Of course. As many as you'll need." Julius's policy was to honor requests for individual sessions with the proviso that members share the details of those sessions at the following group meeting. Julius turned back to Philip. "Back to your question. There's an old therapist trick which provides a graceful evasion of embarrassing questions, and that is to reply, 'I wonder, why are you asking that question?' Well, I am going to ask you that, but I'm not going to evade you. Instead, I'll offer you a proposition. I promise to answer your question fully if you first agree to explore your motivations for asking it. Do we have a deal?" Philip hesitated, then responded, "Fair enough. My motivation for the question is not complicated. I want to understand your approach to counseling and, if possible, integrate any parts that might improve my own counseling practice. I work very differently from you. I don't offer an emotional relationship. I'm not there to love my client. Instead, I am an intellectual guide. I offer my clients instruction in thinking more clearly and living in accord with reason. Now, perhaps belatedly, I'm beginning to understand what you're aiming for. A boober-like I-thou encounter."
"Boober, who?" asked Tony. "Hate to keep sounding like a jerk, but I'm damned if I'm gonna sit here and not know what's going on."
"Right on, Tony," said Rebecca. "Every time you ask a question, you're doing it for me, too. I don't know who Boober is."
Others nodded agreement. Stuart said,
"I've heard the name. Something about I, thou, but that's it."
Pam jumped in.
"Buber's a German-Jewish philosopher, died about 50 years ago, whose work explores the true encounter between two beings. The I-thou, fully present, caring relationship, as opposed to the I-it encounter that neglects the I-ness of the other and uses rather than relates. The idea has come up a lot here. What Philip did to me years ago was to use me as an it."
"Thanks, Pam. I got it," said Tony, and then turned to Philip. "Are we all on the same page?" Philip looked at Tony in a quizzical manner.
"You don't know what that means?" said Tony.
"Gotta get you a dictionary of 20th century talk. Don't you ever turn on your TV?"
"I don't have a TV,"
said Philip in an even non-defensive tone.
"But if you are asking, Tony, whether I agree with Pam's response about Boober, the answer is yes. I could not have said it as well."
Julius was fascinated.
Philip uttering Tony's and Pam's name? Philip complimenting Pam? Were these merely evanescent events? Or might they be heralding a momentous change? How much he loved being alive, Julius thought. Alive in this group.
You still got the floor, Philip. I interrupted you, said Tony.
Philip continued.
So I was saying to Julius, I was saying to you,
he turned to Julius.
Right?
Right, Philip, Julius replied. I think you're going to be a fast learner.
So, Philip went on, speaking in the measured tone of a mathematician. First proposition. You wish to have an I-thou encounter with each client. Second proposition. An I-thou encounter consists of a fully reciprocal relationship. By definition, it cannot be a unilateral intimacy. Third, in the last couple of meetings, people here have revealed a lot about themselves. Hence my entirely justifiable question to you. Are you not required to reciprocate?
After a moment of silence, Philip added,
So that's the conundrum. I intended only to observe how a counselor of your persuasion handles a client's request for parity.
So your motivation is primarily a test of whether I'll be consistent in my approach?
Yes, not a test of you, personally, but of your method.
Okay, I appreciate your position that the question is in the service of your intellectual understanding. Now, just one further query, and then I'll proceed to answer you. Why now? Why ask this particular question at this particular time?
First time it was possible. That was the first slight break in the pace.
I'm not convinced. I think there's more. Again, why now? Julius repeated. Philip shook his head in confusion.
This may not be what you're asking, but I've been thinking of a point Schopenhauer made to the effect that there are few things that put people in a better humor than to hear of another's misfortune. Schopenhauer cites a poem of Lucretius, first century BC Roman poet, Philip said in an aside to Tony, in which one takes pleasure from standing on the seashore and watching others at sea struggle with a terrible storm. It is a joy for us, he says, to observe evils from which we are free. Is this not one of the powerful forces taking place in a therapy group?
That's interesting, Philip, said Julius, but entirely off the point. Let's stay focused on the question of why now.
Philip still appeared confused. Let me help, Philip, Julius prodded. I'm belaboring this for a reason, one which will provide a particularly clear illustration of the differences between our two approaches. I'd suggest that the answer to why now is intimately related to your interpersonal issues. Let me illustrate. Can you summarize your experience in the last couple of meetings?
Silence. Philip appeared perplexed. Tony said,
Seems pretty obvious to me, Professor.
Philip looked at Tony with raised eyebrows.
Obvious? Well, if you want it spelled out, here it is. You enter this group and make a lot of deep-sounding pronouncements. You pull some things out of your philosophy bag that we all dig. Some people here think you're pretty wise, like Rebecca and Bonnie, for example. And me too. You supply all the answers. You're a counselor yourself, and it looks like you're competing some with Julius. Same page?
Tony looked questioningly at Philip, who nodded slightly, indicating that he should continue.
So here comes good old Pam back, and what does she do? Pulls your cover. Turns out you've got a messy past, real messy. You're not Mr. Clean after all. In fact, you really fucked Pam over. You knocked off your pedestal.
Now you gotta be upset about this. And so what do? You come in here today and say to Julius, what's your secret life? You want to knock him off his pedestal, level the playing ground. Same page? Philip nodded slightly. That's the way I see it. Hell, what else could it be? Philip fixed his eyes on Tony and responded, your observations are not without merit. He turned and addressed Julius. Perhaps I owe you an apology. Schopenhauer always warned against allowing our subjective experience to contaminate objective observation.
And an apology to Pam? How about Pam? Asked Bonnie.
Yes, I suppose. That too. Philip glanced fleetingly in her direction. Pam looked away. When it became apparent that Pam had no intention of responding, Julia said, I'll let Pam speak for herself at her own pace. Philip, but as for me, no apology is necessary. The very reason you are here is to understand what you say and why you say it. And as for Tony's observations, I think they're right on target.
Philip, I want to ask you something, said Bonnie. It's a question that Julius has asked me many times. How'd you feel after you left the meeting the last couple of sessions?
Not good. Distracted. Even agitated.
That's what I imagined. I could see that, said Bonnie. Any thoughts about Julius's final comment to you last week? About being given a gift by Stuart and Rebecca?
I didn't think about that. I tried, but just felt tense.
Sometimes I fear that all the strife and clamor here is a destructive distraction taking me away from the pursuits I really value. All this focus on the past and on our desires for change in the future only makes us forget the fundamental fact that life is nothing but a present moment, which is forever vanishing. What is the point of all this turmoil, given the ultimate destination of everything?
I see what Tony means about you never having any fun. It's so bleak, said Bonnie.
I call it realism.
Well, go back to that bit about life being only a present moment, Bonnie insisted. I'm just asking about the present moment. Your present response to being given a gift. Also, I've got a question about our post-group coffee sessions. You charged out pretty quickly after the last two meetings. Did you think you weren't invited? No, let me put it this way. What is your present moment feeling about a coffee session after this meeting?
No, I am unaccustomed to so much talking. I need to recover. At the end of this meeting, I will be very glad to be through for the day.
Julius looked at his watch. We've got to stop. We're running over. Philip, I won't forget my contract with you. You fulfilled your part. I'll honor my next meeting.
27. We should set a limit to our wishes, curb our desires, and subdue our anger. Always mindful of the fact that the individual can attain only an infinitely small share of the things that are worth having. After the session, the group gathered for about 45 minutes at their usual Union Street coffee shop. Because Philip was not present, the group did not talk about him. Nor did they continue to discuss the issues raised in the meeting. Instead, they listened with interest to Pam's lively description of her trip to India. Both Bonnie and Rebecca were intrigued by Vijay, her gorgeous, mysterious, cinnamon-scented train companion, and encouraged her to respond to his frequent emails. Gil was upbeat, thanked everyone for their support, and said that he was going to meet with Julius, get serious about abstinence, and begin AA. He thanked Pam for her good work with him,
Go Pam, said Tony. The tough love lady strikes again.
Pam returned to her condo in the Berkeley Hills just above the university. She often congratulated herself for having the good sense to hold on to this property when she married Earl. Perhaps unconsciously she knew she might need it again. She loved the blonde wood in every room, her Tibetan scatter rugs, and the warm sunlight streaming into the living room in the late afternoon. Sipping a glass of Prosecco, she sat on her deck and watched the sun sink behind San Francisco. Thoughts about the group swirled in her mind. She thought about Tony doffing the costume of the group jerk, and with surgical precision, showing Philip how clueless he was about his own behavior. That was priceless. She wished she had it on tape. Tony was an uncut gem. Bit by bit, more of his real sparkle was becoming visible. And his comment about her dispensing tough love? Did he or anyone else sense how much the tough outweighed the love in her response to Gil? Unloading on Gil was a great pleasure, only slightly diminished by its having been helpful to him. Chief Justice, he had called her. Well, at least he had the guts to say that. But then he tried to undo it by unctuously complimenting her. She recalled her first sight of Gil, how she was momentarily attracted to his physical presence, those muscles bulging out of his vest and jacket, and how quickly he had disappointed her by his pusillanimous contortions to please everyone, and his whining, his endless whining about Rose, his frigid, strong-willed 95-pound Rose, who had the good sense, it now turns out, not to be impregnated by a drunk. After only a few meetings, Gil had assumed his place in the long line of male losers in her life, beginning with her father, who wasted his law degree because he couldn't stand the competitive life of an attorney, and settled for the safe civil service position of teaching secretaries how to write business letters, and then lacked the fortitude to fight the pneumonia that killed him before he could start drawing his pension. Behind him in line, there was Aaron, her acne-faced high school gutless boyfriend, who passed up Swarthmore to live at home and commute to the University of Maryland, the school nearest home. And Vladimir, who wanted to marry her even though he had never gotten tenure and would be a journeyman English composition lecturer forever. And Earl, her soon-to-be ex, who was phony all the way from his Grecian formula hair dye to his cliff note mastery of the classics, and whose stable of women patients, including herself, offered easy pickings. And John, who was too much of a coward to leave a dead marriage and join her. And the latest addition, Vijay? Well, Bonnie and Rebecca could have him. She couldn't rouse much enthusiasm for a man who would need an all-day equanimity retreat to recover from the stress of ordering breakfast. But these thoughts about all the others were incidental. The person who compelled her attention was Philip. That pompous Schopenhauer clone. That dolt sitting there, mouthing absurdities, pretending to be human. After dinner, Pam strolled to her bookshelves and examined her Schopenhauer section. For a time, she had been a philosophy major, and had planned a dissertation on Schopenhauer's influence on Beckett and Gide. She had loved Schopenhauer's prose, the best stylist of any philosopher, save Nietzsche. And she had admired his intellect, his range, and his courage to challenge all supernatural beliefs. But the more she learned about Schopenhauer the person, the more revulsion she had felt. She opened an old volume of his complete essays from her bookshelf, and began reading aloud some of her highlighted passages in his essay titled, Our Relation to Others. The only way to attain superiority in dealing with men is to let it be seen you are independent of them. To disregard is to win regard. By being polite and friendly,
you can make people pliable and obliging. Hence politeness is to human nature what warmth is to wax. Now she remembered why she had hated Schopenhauer. And Philip a counselor? And Schopenhauer his model? And Julius teaching him? It was all beyond belief. She reread the last aphorism. Politeness is to human nature what warmth is to wax. So he thinks he can work me like wax. Undo what he did to my life with a gratuitous compliment on my comments about Buber. Or allowing me to pass through a door first. Well, fuck him. Later she tried to find peace by soaking in her jacuzzi and playing a tape of Goenka's chanting, which often soothed her with its hypnotic lilting melody, its sudden stops and starts and changes of tempo and timbre. She even tried Vipassana meditation for a few minutes, but she could not retrieve the equanimity it had once offered. Stepping out of the tub, she inspected herself in the mirror. She sucked in her abdomen, elevated her breasts, considered her profile, patted her pubic hair, crossed her legs in an alluring pose. Damn good for a woman of 40. Images of her first view of Philip 15 years ago swiveled into her mind. Sitting on his desk, casually handing out the class syllabus to students entering the room, flashing a big smile her way. He was a dashing man then, gorgeous, intelligent, otherworldly, impervious to distractions. What the fuck happened to that man? And that sex, that force, doing what he wanted, ripping off my underwear, smothering me with his body. Don't kid yourself, Pam. You loved it. A scholar with a fabulous grasp of Western intellectual history, and a great teacher, too. Perhaps the best she ever had. That's why she first thought of a major in philosophy. But these were things he was never going to know. After she was done with all these distracting and unsettling angry thoughts, her mind turned to a softer, sadder realm. Julius is dying. There was a man to be loved. Dying, but business as usual. How does he do it? How does he keep his focus? How does Julius keep caring? And Philip, that prick, challenging him to reveal himself. And Julius's patience with him, and his attempts to teach Philip. Doesn't Julius see he is an empty vessel? She entertained a fantasy of nursing Julius as he grew weaker. She'd bring in his meals, wash him with a warm towel, powder him, change his sheets, and crawl into his bed and hold him through the night. There's something surreal about the group now. All these little dramas being played out against the darkening horizon of Julius's end. How unfair that he should be the one who is dying. A surge of anger rose within. But at whom could she direct it? As Pam turned off her bedside reading light and waited for her sleeping pill to kick in, she took note of the one advantage to the new tumult in her life. The obsession with John, which had vanished during her Vipassana training and returned immediately after leaving India, was gone again. Perhaps for good. 28. No rose without a thorn, but many a thorn without a rose. Pessimism as a way of life. Schopenhauer's major work, The World as Will and Representation, written during his 20s, was published in 1818, and a second supplementary volume in 1844. It is a work of astonishing breadth and depth.
offering penetrating observations about logic, ethics, epistemology, perception, science, mathematics, beauty, art, poetry, music, the need for metaphysics, and man's relationship to others and to himself. The human condition is presented in all its bleakest aspects. Death, isolation, the meaninglessness of life, and the suffering inherent in existence. Many scholars believe that, with the single exception of Plato, there are more good ideas in Schopenhauer's work than in that of any other philosopher. Schopenhauer frequently expressed the wish and the expectation that he would always be remembered for this grand opus. Late in life, he published his other significant work, a two-volume set of philosophical essays and aphorisms, whose book title, Parerga and Paralipomena, means, in translation from the Greek, leftover and complementary works. Psychotherapy had not yet been born during Arthur's lifetime, yet there is much in his writing that is germane to therapy. His major work began with a critique and extension of Kant, who revolutionized philosophy through his insight that we constitute rather than perceive reality. Kant realized that all of our sense data are filtered through our neural apparatus and reassembled therein to provide us with a picture that we call reality, but which in fact is only a chimera, a fiction that emerges from our conceptualizing and categorizing mind. Indeed, even cause and effect, sequence, quantity, space, and time are conceptualizations, constructs, not entities out there in nature. Furthermore, we cannot see past our processed version of what's out there. We have no way of knowing what is really there, that is, the entity that exists prior to our perceptual and intellectual processing. That primary entity, which Kant called Ding an sich, the thing in itself, will and must remain forever unknowable to us. Though Schopenhauer agreed that we can never know the thing in itself, he believed we can get closer to it than Kant had thought. In his opinion, Kant had overlooked a major source of available information about the perceived, the phenomenal, world. Our own bodies. Bodies are material objects. They exist in time and space. And each of us has an extraordinarily rich knowledge of our bodies. Knowledge stemming not from our perceptual and conceptual apparatus, but direct knowledge from inside. Knowledge stemming from feelings. From our bodies, we gain knowledge that we cannot conceptualize and communicate because the greater part of our inner lives is unknown to us. It is repressed and not permitted to break into consciousness, because knowing our deeper natures, our cruelty, fear, envy, sexual lust, aggression, self-seeking, would cause us more disturbance than we could bear. Sound familiar? Sound like that old Freudian stuff? The unconscious primitive process? The id, repression, self-deception? Are these not the vital germs, the primordial origins of the psychoanalytic endeavor? Keep in mind that Arthur's major work was published 40 years before Freud's birth, when Freud, and Nietzsche as well, were schoolboys in the middle of the 19th century. Arthur Schopenhauer was Germany's most widely read philosopher. How do we understand these unconscious forces? How do we communicate them to others? Though they cannot be conceptualized, they can be experienced and, in Schopenhauer's opinion, conveyed directly without words through the arts. Hence, he was to devote more attention to the arts, and particularly to music, than any other philosopher. And sex? He left no doubt about his belief that sexual feelings played a crucial role in human behavior. Here, again, he was an intrepid pioneer. No prior philosopher had the insight or the courage to write about the seminal importance of sex to our internal life.
and religion? Schopenhauer was the first major philosopher to construct his thought upon an atheistic foundation. He explicitly and vehemently denied the supernatural, arguing instead that we live entirely in space and time, and that all non-material entities are false and unnecessary constructs. Though many others, Hobbes, Hume, even Kant, may have had agnostic leanings, none dared to be explicit about their non-belief. For one thing, they were dependent for their livelihood upon the states and universities employing them, and hence forbidden to express any anti-religious sentiments. Arthur was never employed, nor needed to be, and was free to write as he wished. For precisely the same reason, Spinoza, a century and a half earlier, refused offers of exalted university positions, remaining instead a grinder of lenses. And the conclusions that Schopenhauer reached from his inside knowledge of the body? That there is in us, and in all of nature, a relentless, insatiable, primal life force which he termed will. "Every place we look in life," he wrote, "we see striving that represents the kernel and in itself of everything. What is suffering? It is hindrance to this striving by an obstacle placed in the path between the will and its goal. What is happiness, well-being? It is attainment of the goal. We want, we want, we want, we want. There are 10 needs waiting in the wings of the unconscious for everyone that reaches awareness. The will drives us relentlessly because, once a need is satisfied, it is soon replaced by another need, and another, throughout our life. Schopenhauer sometimes invokes the myth of the wheel of Ixion, or the myth of Tantalus, to describe the dilemma of human existence. Ixion was a king who was disloyal to Zeus, and punished by being bound to a fiery wheel which revolved in perpetuity. Tantalus, who dared to defy Zeus, was punished for his hubris by being eternally tempted but never satisfied. Human life, Schopenhauer thought, eternally revolves around an axle of need followed by satiation. Are we contented by the satiation? Alas, only briefly. Almost immediately, boredom sets in, and once again we are propelled into motion, this time to escape from the terrors of boredom. Work, worry, toil, and trouble are certainly the lot of almost all throughout their lives. But if all desires were fulfilled as soon as they arose, how then would people occupy their lives and spend their time? Suppose the human race were removed to Utopia, where everything grew automatically and pigeons flew about ready roasted, where everyone at once found his sweetheart and had no difficulty in keeping her. Then people would die of boredom, or hang themselves, or else they would fight, throttle, and murder one another, and so cause themselves more suffering than is now laid upon them by nature. And what is the most terrible thing about boredom? Why do we rush to dispel it? Because it is a distraction-free state, which soon enough reveals underlying, unpalatable truths about existence. Our insignificance, our meaningless existence, our inexorable progression toward deterioration and death. Hence, what is human life other than an endless cycle of wanting, satisfaction, boredom, and then wanting again? Is that true for all life forms? Worse for humans, said Schopenhauer, because as intelligence increases, so does the intensity of suffering. So is anyone ever happy? Can anyone ever be happy? Arthur does not think so. In the first place, a man never is happy, but spends his whole life in striving after something which he thinks will make him so. He seldom attains his goal, and when he does, it is only to be disappointed. He is mostly shipwrecked in the end, and comes into harbor with masts and riggings gone. And then it is all one whether he has been happy or miserable.
for his life was never anything more than a present moment, always vanishing. And now it is over. Life, consisting of an inevitable tragic downward slope, is not only brutal but entirely capricious.